Hi ladies, you're listening to the Goodness Podcast. My name is Noor Tahini. I'm the co-founder of Goodness and I'll be your host today. Goodness was launched in 2018 as a platform dedicated to tackling topics surrounding women's health in a real and honest way. And we're continuing on that mission with the launch of this podcast series, which will feature real women and real stories from the Middle East. My guest on the podcast today is Caroline Leon, an Aussie living in Dubai who has one of the most incredible and inspiring stories of physical recovery I've ever heard.
Hi, Caroline. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Hi, Noor. It's such a pleasure to be here. Your office is so lovely too.
Thank you. So, Caroline, you have a really incredible story of recovery. And it all started for you when you fell off a wall, correct? A climbing wall.
Yep.
What year was that?
I think that was 2015. Yeah, it was 4 years ago, exactly.
Take us back to that day.
Well, to be honest, I was rock climbing. I've been rock climbing since I was really little. I'm Australian. We're a bit stupid like that, a bit fearless. And I used to climb the cliffs in my hometown and climb the cliffs, sit on the cliff face. I'm talking about 100-meter cliffs. Like
no ropes,
bare hands, no ropes, like in a swimming costume and sit at the top, watch people surf, rock climb down, get in the water, walk home. And that was what I used to do after school every day. So I was a little bit on the arrogant side of having such little respect for safety. And because I'd been used to it so much, I saw this climbing wall and I was jokingly to my friend just saying, should we climb it? And I took my shoes off, hitched up my skirt and just started climbing this wall.
How high was it?
It was, I don't know the specifics of the dimensions of the wall, but I think it was about 14 meters in height and I fell. Maybe it's about 10 to 14. I fell from about almost the top, just around the top.
Did you fall when you were climbing up or on your way back down?
No, I climbed up. I was fine. I threw my elbows over the top ledge and watched the sunset and looked at the beautiful horizon in the distance. And then I started to climb down and the first two or three steps that I made downwards, the peg that I was holding on the right side came off and I just lost my grip and I fell. And I landed onto the gravel beneath me, just on my feet. So I landed on my feet and then I fell backwards onto my bottom and then I lay on my back. And at first, I remember my friend screaming and running down the wall and telling me to get up. And I, in my mind, was like, that can't happen. I can't get up. And then thinking to myself when I felt that, like, oh, wow, I can't get up. And then so I tried to roll onto my right side and I felt all the bones in my pelvis move separately. And then I lay on my right side for an instant and I just couldn't be there. It was very instinctual.
Oh,
like
gosh.
I just knew I couldn't lay on that side. And so I rolled onto my left side and I felt all the bones in my pelvis move separately again. And then I had this really distinct feeling that something was really wrong because your bones are not meant to move separately. They're meant to move together. And
I felt that. Were you in pain?
No, I wasn't in pain. But I've read and heard that a lot of people, when they go through lots of shock, you don't experience pain. I think your body goes through this kind of very like, we need to keep you like alive.
Yeah.
So you're either going to experience pain or we're going to keep you alive and you're not going to experience pain. And for me, I didn't experience very much pain. And then until I got into the ambulance and I started being moved. When I started being moved, then I started to feel pain. But initially, no, I didn't feel anything. And yeah, I lay on my left side and I just waited. I remember like segments of things, being really thirsty, really, really thirsty, to the point where that was the only thing I was thinking about. I was just thinking, I'm really thirsty. And I kept saying to my friend, like, you need to call the ambulance. I was really surprisingly quite calm. I didn't scream. I didn't shout. I just, I wanted water. I wanted my friend to call the ambulance, and I just waited. And I put my hands on my heart, and I just started breathing. And I distinctly remember moments where I felt like I was going to close my eyes and go to sleep. And I was just really hypnotized by the sound of my heart. It was like reverberating through my chest. Mm. It was so loud, and that's all I could hear, and just the world shut out. And I do remember, so I was laying on the gravel and I remember the sand around me starting to turn red, and I didn't realize at the time what that was. So my right foot had come out of my body, and it was open and exposed, and I was just bleeding, and I was bleeding all around me. I'm glad I didn't see that, because I would have been mortified. But I do remember when the ambulance arrived, I was still on my side, and they were asking me lots of questions, and then they put a stretcher behind me, and they were like, okay, Caroline, we're gonna roll you onto your back. Just, you know, like, hold on and just stay really still, and we're gonna do everything. And they rolled me onto my back, and that's when I started to feel like a lot of pain, because I felt things moving again. And then I remember the ambulance asking me if I could feel my leg, and he kept touching my leg, going, can you feel this? Can you feel this? And then people were saying that there was something really wrong with both of my feet. Obviously, I'd landed on them and I shattered them. And one of them was open and all of the bone was exposed. And the other one was shattered, but they had gotten really swollen really, really quickly. And because the bones had shattered, they had deformed. And so I remember people saying, like, talking about my feet a lot, but you're in this other planet. I was in another world. I remember it, but I didn't register. Like, it's, you kind of turn into this very primitive person where it's like, oh, people are talking about blood, or they're talking about my feet, but I didn't understand. Oh, they're my feet. That's my blood.
Connect the dots.
No connecting of dots, which is probably for the best. I feel like that's a instinctual thing.
The survival instinct.
Yeah. Yeah.
Were you scared at any point?
No. Like I said to you before, it happens so quickly. And it's not that I made a clear choice not to be scared. I was just very much present to what was happening at that particular moment. And at that particular moment, I was just worried about, I was just thirsty. And I was thirsty. That was it.
Do you know why you were that thirsty?
No. Later on, I understood that I was going through hypervolemic shock. And because I was losing so much blood, my body was really thirsty. And that's one of the counter reactions to that. But at the time, I didn't know that. And I was just, anyone who would come next to me, I was just like, can you get me water? So I was awake the whole time. And when I got into the hospital, I remember getting into the ambulance, and they strapped all of this stuff onto me and strapped my neck up, strapped me to machines and lots of things. And they kept talking to me and just asking me lots of questions. I think they wanted to keep me awake. Mm. And when we got into the hospital, I just remember being surrounded by people and going into a room, and everyone around me grabbed, like, underneath the kind of the stretcher that you're on, and they put you onto another stretcher, and then they wheel you into this huge CT, and it's like this big machine that surrounds you. And that's when everyone kind of knew what was wrong with me. And then they started to cut my clothes off and take my jewelry off, and I was all I was doing is asking all of the nurses for water. And I didn't realize that they weren't giving me water because they were taking me straight to surgery. And I didn't understand that. And then I remember my husband being there and seeing, he looked really concerned. And I was just in a different planet. I was just thirsty. And why are people taking my clothes off? Like, so ridiculously stupid. So those are some of the things that I remember. And then obviously after they cut my clothes off, they put more machines on me. And then I just went into surgery. And then I had 3 surgeries that evening.
And so what was the diagnosis?
So I had shattered both of my feet. So they just crumbled. And my right foot was an open fracture. So in the medial calcaneum, so the inside, it had opened and the bone was outside. So the first surgery I had was to put the bone back inside and to clean it so I wouldn't get an infection. I shattered a couple of other bones in my left foot, and then my pubic bone had snapped off and my right pelvis just crumbled, so it shattered as well. And because the whole thing had broken into so many little pieces and it wasn't attached, so my pubic bone wasn't attached and my whole ilium crumbled, the whole thing had nothing connecting it to the other side, so it just moved up into my rib cage, and and my right leg wasn't connected anymore, and then part of my spine exploded. So when they looked at their CT, they saw that I was missing a segment of spine. It was in my abdomen, and they saw that my pelvis was just in pieces. So I went straight into surgery. But surprisingly, I had my spine stabilized. So they put just rods on the back so it wouldn't collapse into the space that had been created. And then they repaired my foot, and then they put this contraption into my knee to move my leg back down to the right position. So when I woke up, I had this thing inserted into the bone of my leg, my right leg, with this pulley system and 10 kilos on the other end of it. And my feet were all strapped and bandaged, and I was laying flat on a bed, and I wasn't allowed to move, and I had like cannulas everywhere. One was a painkiller and the other one was a blood transfusion, and the other one was something else that I was being given. And surprisingly, I didn't even realize this either, but my little, I kept saying to people like, I need to pee, and my little sister like picked up this bag and she's like, you are like, and I didn't, yeah, there was a catheter, and then I had all of these tubes inside me, and they were like little blood blood buckets, so there'd be a tube in, so all of the excess blood that was coming out would just pool into this little bucket. So I'd have one in my back, I had one in my, two in my feet, one in my hip. So I had all of these tubes coming out everywhere, and I was like, what is all this stuff? Like, you just wake up and you are investigating your own body, and my hand was bruised up until my elbow, and my feet were bruised. That's how I woke up.
How long did you spend in hospital?
The first time I spent 2 months. Just under 2 months. And then the second time, I think I was there 2.5 weeks, and then the third time, another 2 weeks, and then a small sections here and there after that.
Why did you keep going back?
I just had to keep having surgery.
How many surgeries did you have?
I had 14. So I had about seven or eight initially, and then I just had more and more and more as the year went on. So over the course of 2 years, I had 14.
How long was it before you could move even just a little bit in hospital?
So I didn't move at all until right about the end of when I was being allowed to be discharged. So I had had most of my surgeries. Everything was reconstructed again. And then they started giving like physiotherapy. So the physio would come into the room and we would press my hospital bed and it would sit up.
Yeah.
And I'd have to watch the clock and I'd have to sit up for a minute or 5 minutes and then back down. So that was my physiotherapy at the beginning. And the problem with that is that when you're laying on your back for 2 months, you get really dizzy when you sit up and you haven't moved for 2 months. And my right leg was reattached, so I couldn't do anything with it. I couldn't move it. I couldn't do anything. And yeah, so that was the physiotherapy for the first week. And then after that, it was like, okay, you are going to go home soon. So we need to teach you how to be able to get you into a wheelchair. And we need to teach you how to sit in a commode and shower yourself. And I had been, you know, like when you live in hospital, you have like, it's so routine and regimented. So the nurses come in every 2 hours and they check on you. And initially when you're in a ward, like a surgical ward, you're with a lot of people. So they check on you every 5 minutes and you're attached to loads of machines. And then eventually they moved me into my own room, but I had to have someone sleep with me every night. So one of my girlfriends, because obviously they only allow women to come and stay in the women's ward.
Even your husband couldn't.
Wasn't allowed, wow. Yeah. So I had, my friends were doing like a rotation And one of them would come and sleep with me every night. And the nurse would come in every hour or two. And if you have a blood transfusion, they come in every half hour. And they check on you and they do vitals. So it's hard to sleep. But it's very regimented. So you wake up at 7 and they come in and they give you whatever it is that they need to give you. Like you have painkillers every 2 hours and an antibiotic and another blood transfusion or something along those lines. And then they change all your dressings. And when you've had 14 surgeries, there's like...
A lot
of things to do, a lot of stitches to check, a lot of bandages to redo. And then they shower you, and you shower in a bed. So you lay flat on your back, and they're amazing. These nurses are just crazy. So they get this big bucket of water, hot water, and they take off your clothes without you moving. Like you are not a participant in this shower experience. And they undress you, and then they clean you everywhere. And then they put on, like, they shower you in your bed, so they have to change all the sheets from underneath you, and they do that without you even moving. It's really incredible.
How do they do that?
I have no idea.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that you do that every day. So we had to go from that to, okay, now we need to teach you to sit in a commode. Like a commode is like this, it's a wheelchair, but you can go into the shower with it and you can go into the toilet with it. And so that was really hard because I, like, as soon as I sat up, I got dizzy. I felt like I was going to be faint and my back just hurt so much. And then I felt like the whole weight of my torso would just go onto my right hip and I couldn't tolerate it. So even being sitting up for like a minute was torturous. So it was a hard process, but those are some of the things that they teach you before you leave hospital. Mm-hmm. They're the essentials. Like you need to leave hospital being able to get into your own wheelchair, being able to shower yourself to some form of degree. And like, you know, I had ridiculous experiences trying to shower myself. You'd lose the hose. The hose is over there. You can't move. You can't stand up. You're like pushing yourself in a wall, hoping you don't fall over. Like it's ridiculous, but... You know, there's no other way. You have to do it.
What does spending 2 months in a hospital bed do to your mindset? Where was your mind at that time?
I think, like I was saying to you before, your mind gets so primitive. I know mine certainly did. It was so primitive. I wasn't really thinking a lot about anything. I was sleeping most of the time. And then when I was awake, like, it was even hard to talk. So I had a lot of my friends coming to visit me and I would put a pillow over my head because, like, the light hurt my eyes and I would just listen to them talk. And I wouldn't participate in the conversation because it was too, like, hard to talk. But I was there and I was listening and I could hear them. I remember my friends bought me books and I couldn't read them, like... To physically put a book in front of your face and read the words and the sentences was it. My brain couldn't do that. And so you just get very primitive. It's like I'm hungry or I'm thirsty or I need to go to the bathroom or I need to move. And, you know, to move, you need to press your button and you need 5 nurses to come in and maneuver you to a better position. So it's you get very primitive. So my mindset at that time was just like basic. When I got out, it was very different.
Is it like your body was preserving energy for healing as opposed to for anything else?
Yeah, I certainly definitely think that. And I know afterwards, when I was at home, I was sleeping about 22 hours a day. So I was up for a physiotherapy session or hydrotherapy or some therapy, and the therapy was so exhausting that then I would go back to sleep. And even people think that you sit in hospital and you watch all these TV shows that you really want to watch and that, like, oh great, I don't have to work for 2 months, but it's not like that. I couldn't even watch a movie because I couldn't remember what was going on in the movie.
Wow.
Yeah, you get, it's really like back down to basics.
How is it going home? I can't imagine the first car ride home as well. If
yeah.
You can't sit for more than 5 minutes.
It was scary. I was really scared to go home because in the hospital you have so much help and you have a button and you can press the button and a nurse comes in and they roll you to the side, they clean you, they wash you, they feed you, they talk to you, they cry with you, they sit with you. So to have that and then to go home and still not be able to do anything, but have to take the leap. I was really scared. I remember my husband picked me up and he like got me out of my wheelchair, like carried me. And even just him picking me up hurt so much. I remember feeling my pelvis touch his waist. And I just felt like it was a million tons of brick that had just hit my side. And then when we sat in the car, it was so hot and my feet were swollen and I couldn't sit up. So we had to lay the front car seat almost horizontal. And I had pillows on the floor of the car so my feet could rest on them. And then I had pillows everywhere. I had like 20 pillows at home because pillows are the only thing that made anything feel better.
How long had you been married when that happened? When the accident happened?
We'd been together 6 years, but I think we'd been married like 6 months.
So you were newlyweds, basically. Yeah, wow.
Great.
What does that do to your marriage?
It makes it hard, for sure.
But it seems like you guys had a good support system around you.
Yeah, it was beautiful. It was really amazing, especially because you hear so much of people say that Dubai life and Dubai people are so superficial, and then you go through an experience like this for me, and I felt the complete opposite. I felt like everyone that I had worked with or seen or known was just coming to sit with me. And a lot of people, so my husband set up this WhatsApp group, and literally everybody that I knew was on it, and they were just take shifts to come and sit with me in the hospital, especially like I was a vegetable, but especially at some stage I had one of the surgeries that I had, they kind of inflate you with air so that they can remove parts of your spine out. And after that, I couldn't eat because it hurt so much to eat. And I stopped eating, and I didn't realize that I had actually lost so much weight. And everyone, and I was again just a primitive mind, so I was like, I'm not eating because it hurts, that's it. And I didn't realize that on my WhatsApp group people were just coming to make sure that I was eating something and bringing some type of food. And then I was explaining to people like, I can't eat solid food because it hurts, so I just started drinking loads of things. Yeah, it's just basic stuff.
Did you ever think at some point I might never walk again? Like, the negative thoughts cross your mind?
100%. I was told by the hospital that I wasn't going to walk. So they told my husband that at the beginning. And then they were like, let's just see how everything goes. And when I got discharged, they were like, okay, you're going to be able to walk. Like, you're not going to walk well and you're going to be disabled. So I had a really big chat with the doctors about that, about what it would mean to walk again. And they were just very honest with me. They were like, look, everything's different now. You're going to be able to walk and it's going to take a lot of time and you're going to do physiotherapy. This is at the end of my hospital stay, but it's going to be different. And that was when I left hospital and I wasn't such a vegetable, I started to understand the ramifications of everything. And when I could sit up and I could talk to people and I started coming back to life, then it was like, my sisters have this joke internally that they said that I was in the mud because I was literally just so depressed. Mm. It wasn't an easy ride. I was probably the most horrible person to be around because I was so mopey, like Eeyore from Winnie the Pooh.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, that was me. I was just like, you know, what's the point? Like, why am I going to sit up? I'm never going to walk again. Or why am I going to do this? There's no point. Like, just very, I had...
Negative, yeah.
It wasn't even negative. It was just despair.
Wow.
I was just in despair because there's being negative and then there's having this shattering truth. And it's like, okay, I'm not being negative because this is my truth. This is where I'm at right now. I'm just so in despair because of it. Because there's no light. Like, I couldn't see any light. I couldn't see, how am I going to be okay? How am I going to live like this? I'm going to be disabled for the rest of my life. I might walk. Great. Like, what am I going to do?
How did you get out of the mud?
Oh, God, the mud was a long process. It was a really long process. I think once I started to be able to think clearer, I started to read. And I have a medical background. So I have a Bachelor of Medical Science. So I've studied science all my life, and I majored in anatomy and physiology. So as soon as I could read properly and understand what I was reading, I just started reading medical text about the injuries that I had sustained and what were the morbidity and mortality rates from those injuries, and then what people were doing to recover, and if they were recovering, what was happening. And then I was just reading about just some cutting edge therapy things that people were trying. And so I kind of threw myself into that, into understanding, learning. And then when I had just a little bit of hope, I just fed that. So I really didn't allow myself to think anything that wasn't going to get me to the place that I wanted to be. And the place that I wanted to be is I wanted to be better than I was before. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to walk. I wanted to be able to do everything that I did before, and I wanted to do it better. And I just strived towards making that happen. So that means any time that there was someone around me who wasn't on board with that, it was like, that person's gone. Mm. Or if I had a thought that wasn't letting me move forward in that direction, I just shut it down immediately. And then I just started listening to podcasts, and I was listening to reading loads of books about people who had healed themselves, and watching movies about people who healed themselves. And I was just immersed in that. And because I had nothing else to do, I was, you know, jobless for 2 years. So I just read and listened and just digested that. And I started following people on Instagram who were like paraplegics, or there's this girl who had a double amputation, and she's the snowboarding champion. So I was like, yep, I love you. We're in. I'm following your story. I just started following all these other people that were doing amazing things with their life despite disability. And I was just very steadfast in the pursuit of being able to be a normal person.
So literally mind over matter.
Yeah, but it was hard. Yeah. Like, it took a long... Like, it's very easy to say that, but when you are in this state of being, it's hard to propel yourself forward, especially when you are your only motivator. And then once you start to get through that, it's very hard not to be that person anymore. So, like, now... I used to reference myself, oh, like, I can't do that. I'm just the disabled girl. Or you become that persona. You become, like, I become the disabled girl. Like, oh, no, I can't run because I'm disabled. And to get yourself out of that, so it's such a long process. Like, I was in the mud for a long time. I was a mushroom. I was brainless. And then I was in the mud. And then I was this disabled person. And then I was trying to navigate myself out of being that disabled person. And how do I re-identify with somebody else that isn't all of those other things? And that's really hard. It's really hard to let go of that because... it's so easy to be the victim. It's so easy. Mm-hmm. And like, I had good reason. Like, I had great reason. Like, I can't... Can you lift this up for me, please? Because I can't lift it. It's too heavy. And I have a great reason. Like, I wanted to go surfing. I used to drag the surfboard along the floor. And then my friends were like, no, we'll pick it up for you. And eventually I had to say to myself in my mind, no, like, I have to do this. And that's a process in itself.
Mm-hmm. How long did it take for you to walk again?
2 years.
2 years of physio.
Hydrotherapy, physio, osteo. I used to have acupuncture on my leg because it was just lifeless. And then I used to put electrodes on it, and we used to electrocute it so it would bring it to life. Yeah, I did lots of things. My right leg was a dud. It was just... yeah, I didn't do anything for a long time. So being able to feel it, being able to move it. And then when I could move it, it was very basic. Like it can go forwards and backwards. It can't do side to side. It can't roll. It can't rotate. I can't control my foot. Like I can just step forward and it can handle some amount of weight. So I was walking with crutches for a long time. And then I was walking with one crutch for a long time. And then, then eventually I was walking with no crutches, but like I was walking like a retard and no one was telling me until now. If they see me now, they're like, oh my God, you walk so well now. And I'm like, oh, I was walking like a spastic for ages and no one said anything to me.
Do you walk perfectly normally now?
No, I don't.
No.
I have
there's a limp?
Yeah, there's a little limp. It's more apparent when I'm tired and my feet are sore. But when I'm fresh and I'm awake in the morning, I can almost pull off like a normal gait.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And at what point did you decide that it would be a good idea to solo climb I don't know how many mountains?
Look, I had been sitting on this idea that I couldn't be this disabled person anymore and I needed to do something so I would step out of that entirely and I would step into being something different. And it was kind of for me like a challenge to, okay, I'm going to do something that a normal person could do, and if I can do that, then I can't call myself disabled anymore. Like that's chapter closed, new chapter. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So I was with a friend of mine. We were in Australia and we were climbing Australia's highest mountain. It's not high. It's like 2,500 meters. It's Mount Kosciuszko. It's a mini mountain. So we were climbing that mountain and he was like jokingly saying like, you know, we should do a Guinness World Record. And I was like, great, let's find something really easy to do. So I was like, can we like climb Australia's highest mountain in the fastest possible time? Because it's so easy. Anyway, interestingly enough, we climbed the mountain and the last like 2 kilometers, I couldn't walk anymore because my feet hurt so much. So I begged him to ask the park ranger to drive us down the rest of the mountain. And he's like, you want to do something? You can't even walk up one baby mountain. And I was just like, oh, like that's so true. Anyway, in the end, we were like, okay, well, why don't we climb all the mountains in Asia? And I was like, that's Everest. Like, that's too hard. Let's do something easy. So we were looking for a territory that was like, didn't have mountains that were ridiculously high. And I was like, oh my God, the Middle East. The Middle East is my home. Like, I've been to loads of the countries already. Let's do that. And when I looked at the mountains, there were like 2 really high ones and all the rest were really reasonable. Little did I know that they were all in very politically challenging countries. And no wonder no one had done it before. That I didn't realize at the time. So I was like, yes, I found my challenge. I'm going to do this. Like I was a lazy challenge person. I wanted to do an easy challenge.
It was 16 in total?
Yeah, it was 16 in total and I managed to do 10. And the reason that I didn't do the others was because of the political aspect of it, of being in those countries.
The climate in those countries.
Yeah, the political climate, yeah.
And how long did you train or how long did you have that goal in mind before you set out and climbed the first mountain?
So I was in Australia in February and I decided at the end of February, I'm doing this. So it was March and I left in September. So I literally had about 6 months. And at the very beginning, I was just like, okay, I'm going to do these countries. I'm going to go there. And I started planning it out and my husband thought I was ridiculously mental and he was just like, can you just stop talking about this? I don't want to hear it. It's ridiculous. And unfortunately, what started to happen, and this is what I really feel, I feel like sometimes the universe conspires to help you. And in this instance, I've been very fortunate that the universe has given me some very hard lessons, but has also given me the opportunity to also make them into lemonade. Do you know?
Yeah.
So I had this idea and I have no idea how I managed to get so many people to come on board and support it and help and be a part of that, but they did. And so in the back of my mind, I was like, okay, if this isn't meant to be, the universe isn't going to help me. And if it's meant to be and I'm meant to go, the universe is going to help me. And then I got sponsored by DHL. And then, like, just a million other things started to happen. Like, at first, Guinness rejected my application, so I wrote them a rebuttal.
What was their reasoning for it?
It was the reason they rejected it was their subcontinental thing. So the Middle East is subcontinental. And it has very different definitions according to the different literature. So I wrote them this massive rebuttal, very, like, researched. And they were like, okay, fine. Anyway, so there were just a lot of things that happened, and because of that, more people got involved, and it just kind of snowballed, and to the point where I was like, okay, I'm doing this, like, it's happening, I'm going. And that was it. And then for me, at the same time, it was kind of like, okay, well, if I can pull this off, and if I can do this, then I'm not disabled anymore, and I can't talk about that part of my life anymore. Interestingly, I'm talking about it even more now, but do you know what I mean?
Yeah, you can't identify with it.
Yeah, even though, like, I still understand very much the limitations that it has posed. Like, my feet are not normal and my hip is not normal, and I get really sore when I walk for a long period of time. So I understand the limitations of it, but they don't defy how I live the rest of my life.
And how was the experience of climbing all those mountains?
It was amazing.
Like, what was the toughest one?
Probably Iran. Iran was very, very hard because it's so high and it was very cold. So we had minus 11 degrees on the approaching the summit, and there was 60 kilometer winds, and there was sulfur spewing from the volcano.
Wow.
It was really cold. It was really, really, really cold. It was that wind. Like, as soon as you got in the line of the wind, it just felt like you had an elephant on your back and you were frozen solid. So that was very challenging. And my perception of distance, so my guide kept saying to me, oh, we're 200 meters away from the summit, or we're 100 meters away from the summit. And she was talking about elevation, and I was like, talking distance.
Yeah.
So she was saying, you know, we're 200 meters from the summit, but that was 4Ks. I was like, no. So the perception in my mind was just, I felt like it never finished. That mountain went on and on and on. And yeah, it was very mind challenging. And I cried when I got to the top. Like, I could not stop crying. I was trying to take a photo and I just kept crying.
How long was that climb?
That took 5 days.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah.
What was the biggest lesson that you've taken away from all of this?
Probably what I mentioned to you before about the universe conspiring. I think when you are doing something with a good intention and a pure heart and mind, I really do believe that the universe conspires to make things happen. And especially for me, it has happened that way. So I think the biggest lesson that I learned here is kind of just to trust that the things that you want to do and want to achieve in your life are doable, and that you can make them happen. Nothing is ever easy, though. This is the lesson here. People assume, oh, you know, you're healthy, you can walk again. Easy. It's not easy. It's the hardest thing that you can ever do, and it takes everything you have. It takes every aspect of your mind, and you have to be so, like, strict with yourself in terms of, like, for me, my recovery was all about my mind. Like, there came a point where I knew that I could do it. I knew that I could fix part of my body. But my mind was always in this war with itself. And it was about learning to control that and to have a lot of control over it. And I think that's probably one of the greatest things, like, to be able to understand that whatever comes your way is a lesson and it was for you. Like, I used to say this to myself all the time, like, this happened to me because I was ready for this. And because it's happened to me, I am ready for this, and I just have to take it on and do the best job that I can of it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it reminds me of one of my favorite quotes from Gladiator. I love that movie so much. But the quote goes something along the lines of, nothing happens to man that he is not fit to, nothing happens to man that he is not fit by nature to bear. Mm-hmm. So basically, if it's happening to you, it's because you can take it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think once I had that in my mind, I was like, huh, like, I got this. Like, this is someone's, and again, you can take it however it is that you want to, but I have this in my life, like whether the universe has given this to me and I have this and I'm ready for it and I can do this. And instead of thinking like, oh, poor me, like look what happened to me, it's like, wow, thank you. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
so just being able to change that and then knowing and really knowing that it's going to be really hard. It's like you're climbing this mammoth mountain and the only thing that you have against you is your own mind, and your own mind is the most powerful thing. Yeah. It self-sabotages all the way.
But what an incredible skill to take forward with you in life, and to have this understanding and mastery, or maybe not mastery, more of understanding of how your mind works, and to have had the time to spend alone with your mind, which a lot of us don't have. You know, we're just run by our thoughts. We never slow down and take enough time to actually challenge our thoughts and understand where they're coming from and rewire them, which it seems you did a lot of.
Yeah, look, I definitely did, and it's definitely not mastery. I haven't mastered this whatsoever. It's more understanding. Yeah. I understand it. And when it comes, I'm like, oh, okay, I know where this is. I know that. But I think the difference is, I think everyone has the potential to do that. It's just, for me, the stakes were very high. It's like, I'm either never going to walk again or I'm going to try. And that distinction alone made all the difference. Whereas for most people, it's like, oh, I don't need to train my mind because, like, I'm going to grab this latte or I'm going to have black coffee because I'm on a diet. Do you know? The stakes are really low. So you don't have this just urgency to actually train your mind or to actually understand that. I think that's the only difference. And really, perspective. Perspective is just paramount. Like, I can look at this situation and think like, this happened to me, and be really upset and just deflated by it, or I can just flip it around and be like, this happened to me, thank you, and make the best out of it, because now I just see this as, okay, I was given a little treasure, and not very many people are given the opportunity to experience that, because I learned a lot from it. I learned a lot in terms of like, you know how when people say monkey mind, very much, but your body, wow, it's this intelligence that is undeniably profound and just so, it needs to be revered, because whilst my mind was in the gutter, my body internally was like, every single cell was fixing something else and was putting me to sleep because I was rubbish and it needed to fix everything else.
Yeah.
So it needed to repair my bones, it needed to do this, it needed to make more blood, it needed to fix my spine. Like, do you understand? It was just working around the clock to make things better, and here I was in my own mind, like in this just dungeon, and it was unbelievably intelligent in what it's capable of. And I think when you give it the right conditions and you let it do its thing, it's just going to fix everything anyway. So
I think intelligence is definitely the right word here. There's like an innate knowledge in your body. The body knows how to fix itself and knows what it needs to do.
Yeah, it's like cellular DNA. It's just, it's like, it's going to open this blueprint and it's like, oh, look, your bones are not meant to be this way. Let's fix that. Just very, very matter of fact. It's undeniably intelligent. And I remember having moments where I was at home in my hospital bed at home and I would fall asleep. 20 hours later, I'd wake up and I could like wiggle my toe, or I could feel something was different. And I started to have that so much that I was like, oh my God, my body is making me sleep because it needs to fix things. And I could literally feel it fixing things. I could feel it fixing everything. It was just unbelievable to wake up and have that knowledge, and just know that.
Yeah, that's incredible. And now that you're back from your adventure, what's the plan? What are you working on?
Oh, God. Now, I spent the last 2 weeks resting just in every fathomable way. I don't know. I'm sitting with it. I'm figuring out what it is. I know that I really want to spend a lot of my time focusing, obviously, on my business. And then there's a lot of other things that I want to do, and I'm trying to figure out what they are. I know I definitely want to do another challenge, so to speak. I'm trying to figure out what resonates with me and what is the right thing to do next. And I've had a couple of ideas in my mind, and I'm playing around with them and seeing, you know, have I really lost the plot this time or just that. And then also being able to share this with other people, because just some of the lessons that I've learned, I really see people in lots of different circumstances, and they don't really know that the only person in their way is themselves. And if I can help other people understand that, then amazing.
And so you mentioned your business, you're planning there. So it's called A Life of Education.
Yeah.
And it's an online learning platform.
Mm-hmm.
And what's sort of the message behind it?
So this is something else that I started after my accident. And it basically is about helping other people educate themselves. So one of the things that I noticed after my accident is, like, I was very fortunate to have a lot of knowledge about anatomy and physiology because I had studied it. And when I went and was searching for PTs that could help me rehab the stuff that I couldn't do, there was a huge gap. So people were professing that they were rehab specialists and they weren't really. And they didn't really know what to do with my body. And some of them did some atrocious things with me. And I wanted to find a way to make education accessible and affordable and be everywhere. So even if you're in the midst of Saudi Arabia or in any other rural place, that you had the opportunity to go, oh, okay, I have a client who has this condition. How can I learn about that condition? How can I find more information?
So it's training for professionals.
Yeah, it's basically for fitness professionals, for physiotherapists, and for doctors or anybody in that medical or fitness professional world that is looking to further their education. So we procured and filmed and made loads of content. Some of them is like fitness for menopausal women, others like fitness for pregnancy, just very subcategories of things that people could learn more from. So that was kind of one of the lessons that I also learned throughout my whole accident process, and something that I wanted to give back to other people. And really, like, it was very shocking to me experiencing this, how expensive being injured is. It's so expensive.
Did you have health insurance that covered all of this?
No, I didn't have any health insurance. I had to pay for everything. And I was really fortunate to have a lot of amazing people around me who, like, my friends set up a GoFundMe account. They raised 150,000 dirhams to help. So I was really, really fortunate. But again, like, it was expensive, like paying 450 dirhams for a physio, and you have to do physiotherapy every day for 2 years. And then on top of that, you have to do hydrotherapy, which is another 500 dirhams. You have to get like vitamin C infusions, which are 2,000 dirhams. And then you have like oxygen therapy and this and that. And you start to like...
Really adds up.
Oh my God. You're spending 2,000 dirhams a day on like therapies and it comes down to, okay, like I need to do this because I want to get better, but man, it's expensive. And it really made me see this other side of the medical industry, and I wanted to not be a part of that. And the affordability part was really, really a big aspect of that, because I know what it's like. You know you have to do this therapy and you're like, oh, but should I not do it because it's so expensive? Yeah. So understanding that.
One last thing. Could you share with our listeners your social media account, your Instagram handle, so they can connect with you and follow your adventures?
Sure. So I can be found on Instagram mostly at Caroline, so Caroline, and then underscore D, and then underscore Leon, so Leon. And I've been posting kind of my whole trip on there. So if you have a look at all of the story highlights, you can see like Saudi Arabia and Bahrain and Oman and the UAE. And I kind of have taken people on a little bit of a journey through each of the countries. It's mostly through airports and mountains. So if you're not into mountains, then maybe stay clear.
Thank you so much, Caroline. It was great speaking with you today.
No worries.
Thanks for listening today. If you're not familiar with Goodness, head to www.goodness.me to access the online platform and articles, and follow us at Goodness on Instagram. If you enjoyed this podcast, please rate, review, and share it, and we'll see you next week.